Look, lady. You think the kids will eat this? Look, lady. Pork and beans.
And no capiche.
Look, here, see, lady? This pitcher on a can. Pork and beans.
Oh, a mangiare. Fagioli.
Yeah.
Oh, ragazzi, venite subito, subito.
Hey, what did I tell you, Max? If it can be it, they always get the idea.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, and doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, April 28, 1946, we present the 24th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
ships to sea, the future of our merchant marine.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Today, all over these United States, travel-hungry people are poring, hopefully, over booklets gay with color and with pictures of lands beyond the horizon. Today, American businessmen, their minds on the time when production will have more than caught up with our shortages, are stumping the experts with questions on when they will be able to ship their products abroad again to the markets of the world. Standing by at the Siemens Institute here in New York with NBC's Dick Dudley is purser Phil May, veteran of Merchant Marine Service in war and in peace.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. Today, government experts, the shipping industry, and the men who work the ships face a difficult reconversion problem to peacetime operation. With me here in Washington to share in our report on the progress of this reconversion are Captain Edward McCauley, acting chairman of the United States Maritime Commission, and Alman E. Roth, president of the National Federation of American Shipping. We are standing by.
The modern development of our merchant marine really got underway only 10 years ago when Congress passed the Merchant Marine Act of 1936. For almost 100 years before that, our merchant marine had been in a steady decline, a far cry from the early proud days when we developed and gloried in the clipper ships, the fastest, most beautiful ships ever to sail the seas, with crews that could take them anywhere and do anything.
Aye, look at her trim there.
Get a good look at her.
She's carrying a lot of canvas.
Aye, looks like a Spanish frigate.
It looks like a limey to me.
Yeah, a British square rigger, I'd say.
Yeah, I wonder where she's headed.
British square rigger off the port bow, sir.
Ahoy there! What ship are you?
A Yankee clipper out of Boston. What ship are you?
The Lady Gwendolyn out of Liverpool.
A barrel of rum we beat you into Shanghai.
A barrel of rum it is, Yankee.
Years since then, our merchant marine reached a sad state. The Merchant Marine Act of 1936 was passed to prevent a repetition of our 1914 experience, when war caught us with our tonnage down. During the First World War, we built an expensive emergency fleet. And when that war ended, what did we do with the ships?
Yes, sirree, gentlemen, opportunity is knocking. The opportunity of the century. Gentlemen, I have here the deed to an unused, brand-new, beautiful Hog Island cruiser. It'll make you rich if you're not rich already. It'll make you happy if you're not happy already. Uncle Sam plunked down $250,000 for it. Yes, sir, $250,000. But you, gentlemen, you can have it for a song. All right, gentlemen, who'll bid $20,000? Only $20,000 for this brand-new, $250,000 vessel.
The That was the lesson of the last war, and we learned it fairly well. Not right away, not until 1936, in fact, but still not too late. By the time the Axis war swept in on us, we had built our tonnage to cover 12 million deadweight tons.
That was good, but not good enough. Especially when, as the war went on, the enemy's undersea power hit us again and again and again.
Torpedo off the starboard bow!
The U-boats took a terrible toll. To counteract it, we poured men, materials, money, billions of dollars into the shipyards of the nation in a desperate race against time. And in the shipyards of the nation, we performed a great production miracle. The figures?
September 1939, deadweight tons over 12 million. September 1945, deadweight tons almost 57 million.
At the end of the war, we had five times as much tonnage as in 1939, more tonnage than all the rest of the world put together. Today, we are the only country in the world with a surplus of merchant ships.
Yes, and today, as in so many other fields, what was a lifesaver in war may become a terrific headache in peace. Today, our war-built ships are surplus property.
Surplus, McCormick, yes, they are surplus, but that's mighty fortunate for the world just now, because we have enough ships, not only for our own needs, but for the shipment of American livestock to replenish the pitifully small herds remaining in liberated Europe, and for American wheat for people abroad with hunger-swollen bodies. Not enough yet, far, far from enough yet to meet the crisis. But today, the American people are embarked on a great campaign to save wheat, fats, and oils. And as fast as more foodstuff becomes available, our merchant marine will take it wherever it's needed. So our surplus of ships is indeed a blessing for all the world.
Yes, St. John, I think we all understand how important the merchant marine is for our national security and for emergencies like those the world faces today. But I wonder how many Americans realize the part the merchant marine plays in our everyday life.
Joe, what do you want for breakfast this morning? Coffee, tea, or cocoa?
Make it cocoa this morning, honey.
Okay, Joe.
Make it a Coke, Charlie.
Okay.
No, give me a pineapple sundae.
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. Make it a banana split. Yeah.
Hey, why don't you make up your mind?
Imagine it. I had to try 24 shoe stores before I found these. Honest, 24.
Coffee, tea, cocoa, pineapples, bananas, cola beans, most of our leather. These and thousands of other products, big and small, that we use every day, all come from abroad. All of them are carried to us by the merchant marine. The service rendered the nation by our merchant marine has become a thing that most of us, well, just take for granted. But the future that lies ahead for commercial shipping in this country, the problems that beset it, are by no means simple matters. We have built the greatest merchant navy in the world, but what are we going to do with it? Will foreign commerce increase sufficiently to use all these ships? What is the reconversion picture, the prospects for travel? Are we moving ahead in the matter of new ship designs? Here are some of the answers.
The question of increase in foreign trade makes me think of our GI ambassadors, ambassadors ex officio and without portfolio. You've all remembered those stories of the generosity and humanity displayed by our soldiers toward the children of the war-torn countries. I've seen it happen myself many times just around the corner from a pitched battle with the enemy.
Mac-a-nyan-ke.
Who's that?
Chewing gum.
Huh? Oh, well, I'll be... Okay, little shaver. Here you are.
Chewing gum.
Here, take the rest of the pack. Oh, yeah, and just chew it. Don't swallow it.
Chewing gum.
Captain, please, Captain, chocolate.
Huh? Hey, I ain't no captain, fella. I'm just a private first class stuck here in Africa. But for you, I got an okay Hershey bar with almonds.
Thank you, Captain.
Look, you think the kids would eat this? Look, lady, pork and beans.
Oh, no, capiche.
Here, see this, lady? Picture on a can. Pork and beans.
Oh, a mangiare.
Here.
Fagioli. Yeah. Ragazzi, vieni di subito.
What did I tell you, Max? If it can be it, they always get the idea.
Yeah.
Faced by the sight of the starving, our GIs reacted as human beings. They passed out to the people of the devastated countries hundreds of American name brand products, canned goods, toothpaste, soap, whatever they could get hold of. Unconsciously, then, our soldiers were also functioning as salesmen, making our products known in the farthest corners of the world.
Add to this the tons upon tons of products shipped to our allies through Lend-Lease, and you have an uncalculated promotion of American goods. American businessmen are looking forward to the time when our own shortages will have been made up and these goods can be sent overseas. And when they are, they'll find the American Merchant Marine ready to carry them. An increase in foreign commerce, then, is a definite promise for the future. What of the reconversion of war-built cargo ships? At the present moment, the Merchant Marine is still operating almost entirely under wartime emergency controls. How long before these controls will be removed entirely?
Well, by the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, Congress made it our government's responsibility to foster an adequate Merchant Marine, a job that is being handled by the United States Maritime Commission. And waiting here in our Washington studios to tell us about the latest developments in the reconversion is the man directly responsible for this work, the acting chairman of the Maritime Commission, Edward McCauley.
To condense the post-war policy of the United States Maritime Commission and the nation's merchant marine into this program is not possible. First, we believe our Merchant Marine should be privately owned and operated in accordance with the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 and the Merchant Ship Sales Act of 1946. Second, we believe that our merchant fleet should be adequate, A, to serve properly the 30-odd trade routes declared essential to the nation's economy, and B, to serve our country in time of emergency and war. Third, we will encourage competition between American flag operators, subsidized and non-subsidized, to the end that our fleet may operate efficiently and at low cost to the taxpayers. We do not believe that the granting of an operating subsidy constitutes a monopoly, but puts our operators on a parity with foreign operators. Fourth, we believe that our merchant seamen have earned the right to employment on an annual basis, with decent living and working conditions, and adequate health and safety programs, and to be technically trained in government-maintained or supervised schools. Fifth, we believe that the Maritime Commission and the merchant marine industry should maintain close liaison with other government agencies, industry, and agriculture. We believe an informed and understanding public will assure national support of these objectives. Our country needs its merchant marine. Our merchant marine contributes hundreds of thousands of dollars to the pay envelopes of American industry and agriculture. It carries hundreds of thousands of tons of supplies to meet worldwide economic needs. It was essential to victory in war and is just as essential in peace. It is our merchant marine. Let's use it.
Thank you, Captain McCauley. One of the things that for many years now has plagued the shipping business in this country is the big differential between the wages paid by our lines and by foreign lines, in spite of government subsidies which only partially offset the handicap. Looking ahead, the American shipping industry sees a helpful prospect in the International Maritime Conference scheduled to be held in Seattle this June, when delegates of the shipowners, maritime unions, and governments of 20 maritime powers will meet. Their aim? To establish international minimum standards of wages, hours, and working conditions on board ship.
In the course of the war, our merchant marine labor force grew from less than 50,000 men to 240,000, almost a quarter of a million. For a picture of how reconversion and the future shape up to the men who work the ships, we take you now to the Seamen's Institute overlooking the New York waterfront, where NBC's Dick Dudley is standing by with purser Phil May.
We're in the lounge of the Seamen's Institute, where the men who man the ships that carry our flags over the seven seas catch a few moments of relaxation before shipping out. And right beside me is purser Phil May of Oakland, California, who shipped both as a purser and artist and painted life at sea both here and abroad. Well, how long have you been in the Merchant Marine, Phil?
Long enough to see 100,000 miles of ocean.
And plenty of action, I'll bet. How about it?
At Antwerp, where we were bringing in supplies for the invasion of Holland, we witnessed the height of the buzz bomb attacks by the Germans.
What did you do in the Pacific?
Then in the Pacific, we lost our bearings in a typhoon and got shipwrecked on Jap-held Mara Island in the Carolines.
Did those Japs give you any trouble?
No. There were several hundreds of them there, too. Guess they figured about 70 seamen and members of the armed guard were just too much for them.
Well, now that the war's over, Phil, are you going to give up the sea and return to a life of a painter and a landlubber?
No, indeed. I've painted all through the war anyway.
Yeah, I understand you're having a one-man show at the Grand Central Galleries in October.
Yes, but I shipped on with the Merchant Marine because there was a job to do. There's still a big task ahead of us. American food and the products Yank soldiers and sailors told the world about. They must reach the hungry and needy people of the world. So I'm going to stay in and help. It's a lifetime job with a grand future.
It certainly is. Well, thank you, Phil May, and best of luck to you. And now this is Dick Dudley at the Seamen's Church Institute in New York City, returning you to the National Hour.
Yes, yes, madam, but wait a minute. We're in the middle of a broadcast.
Oh, yes, I know, about the Merchant Marine. That's why I'm here. You know, I'm a great National Hour fan, and when I heard that this week's broadcast would be about the Merchant Marine, I said to myself at once, that nice Mr. St. John of the National Hour is just the man to help me with my problems.
That's all right, madam, but what is your problem?
I just can't make up my mind where to take a cruise this summer. They say Hawaii is so romantic, and Rio de Janeiro is a dream. And did you see Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca? Then there's India, where the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. Where shall I go, Mr. St. John?
If I were you, madam, I'd go home. I'd go home and start writing to the shipping lines and the travel bureaus. The question of the month is not, where shall I go, but when can I go? Here, let's have a look at the real thing.
What can I do for you, sir?
I want to take my wife on a cruise this summer. She had to put up with a lot and worked like a slave during the war. It doesn't much matter where we go as long as it's pleasant. What do you suggest?
Well, let me have your name and address, please. There's going to be some limited cruising to the West Indies, and I'll try to get you a booking. But I can't promise anything. Not this summer.
Yes, madam. Can I help you?
I've been saving for a trip abroad for a long time, and I have enough now. And, sir, I've been teaching French in our county high school for 21 summers, and I've never been to France, and I would like to go this summer.
Well, I'm afraid it's not likely. You see, there are still government restrictions on pleasure travel to Europe.
No.
Oh, yes, but here, fill out this card. And if there's a change, I'll let you know.
Reservation desk, good morning.
Oh, say, I'm planning a trip to South America this summer. Can I make a reservation for a family of four?
Oh, we happen to be booked solid for the next 2 years. I can put you down for 1948. Or perhaps I might suggest you call some of the other lines.
Well, then, when can I take a cruise, Mr. St. John?
Well, by this fall, a fair number of new and reconverted ships should be coming off the ways in time for considerable winter travel. By the summer after this one, American shipping men say that they will be able to provide us with the finest passenger and high-speed cargo service in our history, unexcelled anywhere in the world. Yes, by the summer of next year, most Americans who want to travel will be able to go wherever world conditions permit on American ships. And so, hang on to your travel pamphlets, lady. Before long, Americans shall be going places again. There's another question Americans have been asking. What will the new American ships be like? The airlines are streamlined already, and the railroads are modernizing right and left. Are American ship owners on the ball?
Well, down here in Washington, the National Federation of American Shipping has been conducting a survey among its members. Partial returns so far show that 11 steamship owners plan to build 90 new vessels, costing $500 million. With a total passenger capacity of 15,000 travelers per trip. They'll range from budget-saving 12-passenger cargo vessels to ultra-modern, luxurious 1,000-passenger liners. Speeds will run from 16 to 30 knots or more, compared to pre-war speeds of 12 to 22 knots.
Okay, but what about the ships themselves? Make with the details.
On that, the National Hour consulted an expert. We asked, what will the ships of tomorrow be like?
The changes in ship design growing out of wartime developments won't be anywhere near as radical as in railroads and planes. Of course, you know there are definite limits to how much we can change the underwater shape of the hull.
You mean no streamlining, no spaceship style?
Well, about the superstructure, the part above the water, the superstructure will be semi-streamlined, and it's going to look very attractive.
Hmm.
But the Buck Rogers style is probably out.
Then what do we have left?
A great deal. There's radar, which will practically do away with collisions and also groundings. And then there's Loran, which will let a navigator know his ship's position at all times, no matter what the weather is.
Well, how about jet propulsion?
Well, there are some experiments with gas turbines underway right now. It's too early for any very definite results, but there's reason to believe that some form of it will prove practical for ships.
Well, how about atomic energy?
Well, on that, opinions differ. Some say maybe surprisingly soon. Others say it's far, far away.
What about gadgets?
Ah, yes. Light metals and plastics will be widely used. There's one company that's even considering building all aluminum ships.
Well, here's the last question. How safe will these ships of tomorrow be?
As you probably know, the fireproof construction methods required by American law already make American ships the safest in the world. With radar, the security will be as complete as human efforts can now make it.
Yes, there's going to be a new subject for argument in a lot of American homes soon. It will probably go something like this.
What are you doing, dear?
Yeah, planning.
Planning what, dear?
Why, that vacation trip we're making next year.
Oh, no, I've been checking with the shipping lines myself.
Well, you needn't have. We're going by air.
I think not, dear. We are going by sea.
And waste 5 or 6 days looking at the Atlantic? Oh, we'll fly it overnight. Give us all that extra time in Europe and Africa.
Oh, you'd think that this was a business trip, the way you talk, Speed. Why, half the fun of vacationing is in taking things easy and relaxing. There's nothing like a sea voyage for that.
Well, take a look at these plane pictures, my dear, and you'll change your mind.
All right, then. You take a look at these booklets. You'll change your mind.
You know, dear, this is the 20th century.
Yes, and these are 20th century ships. They're post-war. Look at the pictures of these staterooms. Why, they're even nicer than the hotel rooms we had at Palm Beach.
Yeah, they're all right for ships, but I like space.
But these fixtures fold into the walls to give more space in the daytime. And look at all the recreation facilities. Game decks, a super parlor, movies, dancing, an indoor swimming
pool. And when we get to the Mediterranean, think of the heat.
We won't have to. The staterooms will be air-conditioned.
Well, now, dear, let's not get excited. Let's talk this over reasonably.
Sir, yes, sir, there's going to be a new subject for argument in a lot of American homes. And here with me in Washington to give us an answer to this argument is one of the shipping industry's leading spokesmen, President of the National Federation of American Shipping, Alman E. Roth. Mr. Roth.
The answer to this argument is to permit American steamship lines to operate airplanes in conjunction with their ships. Passengers could then go one way by air and one way by sea, with both services furnished by the same company on one ticket. A poll of American ocean travelers shows that 40% prefer combination sea and air journeys.
Well, are American steamship companies in a position to offer such sea-air service, Mr. Roth?
They're anxious to inaugurate combination sea-air services, Mr. McCormick. But so far, the Civil Aeronautics Board has not seen fit to grant oversea flying rights to American steamship lines. Yet at this very moment, foreign airlines, some of which are controlled by foreign steamship companies, are being licensed by the American CAB to fly over routes now served by American shipping lines. To compete with foreign transportation, we must be able to offer the best in service, speed, and comfort. Since foreign steamship lines will offer combined sea air service, we must be able to offer the same. Unless we do this, we shall drive our travelers straight into the arms of foreign competitors.
Well, aside from the sea air issue, what concerns the shipping industry most at this time, Mr. Roth?
Our principal concern is to complete our war and rehabilitation tasks and to get back to normal operations. We still have millions of tons of relief and rehabilitation cargoes to move to the far corners of the earth. In the meantime, the American passenger lines are reconverting their vessels and building new ships with which to furnish the fastest, the most dependable, and the safest service which the American Merchant Marine has ever offered to the public.
Thank you, Mr. Roth.
Our Merchant Marine, its reconversion and its future has been the subject of our documentary. And this is what we have learned.
That today the United States has a merchant marine with ships to spare for all the needs of a war-shattered world. That a fair and well-thought-out program has been voted by Congress for disposing of our surplus ships. That American ship owners are planning for the finest and the safest ships in the history of navigation. That sea travel will be greatly limited for the next few months and will then begin to open with full operation by next summer. That in the long view, the future of the merchant marine depends largely on whether we in the world move toward ruthless nationalistic competition from behind high trade barriers or toward greater cooperation and interchange of goods and understanding among all the nations of the world.
On this subject, then, our documentary is ended.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen again next Sunday when our subject will be The Story of an Island.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, and from the Siemens Institute in New York, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 24th in its series on current national problems and affairs. Our guests were Edward McCauley, Acting Chairman of the United States Maritime Commission, Alman Roth, President of the National Federation of American Shipping, and Purser Phil May. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.